Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hello, everybody. Good day. This is the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I'm Matt Tebbe with Ben Sternke.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Good, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing all right. My back. I hurt my back.
I know this. Deadlifting.
I hurt my back a couple weeks ago, deadlifting, and got some great advice from you after the fact about how I shouldn't have done that because I'm 45 and my body doesn't work how it's supposed to anymore. Apparently.
Take care of yourself.
Anyway, I'm feeling better though. I do. It's been a couple weeks. It took a while. I think I just strained a muscle, but went to the chiropractor finally.
Good.
But yeah, so I'm feeling better.
All right, good.
Feeling good today. It's not quite as sore as I used to be.
Strained muscles are better than slipped discs, etc., right?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
From what I hear, I don't think I've ever had a slipped disc.
Yeah. If you are like Ben and
45 years old, wanting to do deadlifts. Is that what you mean?
No, if you are new to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, or maybe this community, maybe you found our podcast because somebody sent you a link, or you accidentally listened, or I don't know, you're winning a bet by listening to all of our podcasts, etc. I want to invite you to sign up for our email list. We have an email list. Yeah. We don't spam you. We send out great emails, usually once a week, with resources and links that I think is one of the best resource link emails in the business.
In the business.
So yeah,
it's not free. Not to pat ourselves on the back.
It's one of the ways to kind of move more central to kind of who we are as an organization and what we're about. You'll get a flavor and a sense for what we do, and you will also in that email just stay updated on various other things we offer as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like being part of our online community. We're working on some new ways to kind of create even more connectivity among the people who are part of our community. But for right now, that's a really great way just to join that email list. And every Friday, typically, we send out a list of just links that we found interesting that we think are helpful for Christian leaders to navigate culture and faith today. Stuff that we found helpful. So we assume it's helpful for others as well.
Yeah.
So yeah. Oh, Matt, how can they sign up for that?
If you go to, you'll need access to the interweb.
Oh, the internet.
And then you will need to open your Netscape browser and navigate to www.gravityleadership.com. And then there's a big button right there. This is join. Join us.
Yep. Or you can go to gravityleadership.com/join. If you want to go straight there and just put in your email address, you get a little confirmation email. Click that. You're signed up. You did it.
Yep, that's how you do it. What are we doing here today? We're just talking about backs and email lists.
Yeah,
what are we doing?
Yeah, deadlifts, muscle strains, curated lists. No, we're also going to be talking with Crispin Mayfield today about his work with spiritual attachment styles.
Yeah.
We actually booked this interview before we realized that he was in the process of writing a book about this, but
right.
There is a book that's coming out. It's not coming out till February, but you can pre-order it, which is, you know, that's always helpful for authors from what I hear.
Yes.
But this is a fascinating conversation. You know, we interviewed Jeff Holzclaw a few weeks ago about the same kind of topic. It's the intersection of brain science, attachment theory, and faith. But this stuff really is illuminating. It's really, really helpful. And this interview with Crispin it blew my mind in several ways. I felt convicted and very illuminating in terms of realizing not only how like our attachment style relates to how we imagine our life in God, our life with God, but also how whole like movements or kind of theological traditions can be born out of or explained by, you know, attachment theories.
Mm-hmm.
That was also just fascinating to think about. So anyway, this was great. I loved doing this interview. I loved
it. Yeah,
loved
there were a few times I couldn't help myself.
Yourself, and you just did what?
I just
started speaking
in tongues.
Blurted
things out. No, I just began to, over exuberant.
Yeah. Noises, grunts, various grunts. That could be speaking in tongues. Maybe you were speaking in tongues.
I'm pretty sure I would know.
Okay.
Yes, the spirit would groan inside me. I would know. No, it was just more of being like a, you know, B-minus podcast host. But Crispin's great. This book is great. And I think there's much more work to be done in unpacking the implications for what he has to say.
Yeah.
Much more.
For sure. We'll probably keep talking about it with others, that kind of thing. But for now, enjoy Crispin Mayfield talking about spiritual attachment styles.
Yeah. Gird up the mirror holes.
Uh-huh. What style are you? Find out in just a few moments. All right. Crispin Mayfield, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. Matt is here as well. Hey, Matt.
Hey, yo.
And we're going to talk today with Crispin about spiritual attachment styles, specifically through the lens of leadership, kind of being able to notice our own defaults, being able to notice them at work with those that we serve and lead, all of that kind of thing. But before we dive into that and figure out what this is all about, Crispin, do you want to just do a brief introduction of yourself to our audience?
Yeah. So I am actually a pastor's kid and a missionary kid. And so that's my origin
double
story.
Whammy. Is that a,
yes.
Yeah. Is that a, is there a name for that? I mean, that feels like there should be a, do you get a superpower with that?
That does sound like a classic origin story for why you went into counseling.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, in a lot of ways, that's a whole other aside, but just worth mentioning that my parents, their missionary, kind of strategy was like, we're going to target, we're going to build relationships with like powerful people in this society and, you know, kind of trickle down evangelism thing. So it's no surprise that when my wife and I, joined a mission organization, it was like working amongst like the most poor and marginalized people. Right. So, you know, you see that swing, like I'm going to do the exact, I'm doing the same. I'm still in ministry. But I'm doing the exact opposite of what my parents did.
Yeah,
so,
all right.
Yeah. How long did you do that mission work?
So we were in inner city Minneapolis for 3 years. And so I graduated with my master's in counseling. We moved there for 3 years, and I did a lot of community-based stuff in different ways. Some community mental health, but also some just even kind of broader in a sense of building relationships in a community. And then we moved back to Portland around the time that our second kid was born. And we've been hanging out on the west edge of Gresham, or on the edge of Portland, the west edge of Gresham, which is a suburb of Portland, to be specific. And I've been practicing as a therapist at an ADHD clinic, of all things, for about 5 years. I love folks with ADHD, but I've really just over time shifted into doing mostly couples therapy with people with ADHD, with, you know, oftentimes a partner with ADHD. But really, my focus there is on attachment and that relationship between partners. So
I am texting my wife now, letting her know I found someone we need to meet. No, that's amazing. How did you get into ADHD couple counseling? Because I may know somebody who has ADHD, who's married.
Yeah, well, so to be totally transparent, I was working at one clinic and my friend was like, hey, you should come work with me at this ADHD clinic. And I was like, I don't know. And then they were like, well, you can have your own office and choose your own hours. And and we have a waiting list of people waiting to see a therapist. Because a lot of people know, like, when you first start out, it's just hard to get it going. And and so it was
around... You said, how did you know I loved ADHD?
Right, exactly. I actually, in the interview, I was like, I literally told them, like, I don't like to, like, work too hard. I like a good, like, life-work balance. And they're like, but yeah, I've really enjoyed it. It was a really good fit for our family. Because previously, you know, when you first start out, you're working in the office of someone that works during the day, and then you get to use their evening hours or weekend hours. And, but I really enjoyed it because I find that a lot of people with ADHD are really more comfortable in their own skin. You kind of have to learn, like, okay, I have these deficits of memory or attention or whatever it is. And so that idea of trying to, like, act like I have it all together kind of goes out the window. And there's a lot of pain for people that grew up with ADHD in a, you know, usually an educational system that doesn't work very well. But what I do find overall working with adults with ADHD is there's this element of being able to kind of, like, look at myself and be like, yeah, these are my strengths, these are my weaknesses, and I can be pretty upfront and authentic about that. So, yeah. I knew that emotionally focused therapy, which is a couples therapy, was based in attachment. I'd already been interested in attachment by that point. And so I was like, let's give this a shot. So, and it was really life-changing, really, to go through they have a pretty rigorous training process, and that process itself was really transformative for me. So
Just going through the training to help other people, you found yourself helped.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. A lot about how do you be with people in a really present way? How do you help people access what's going on emotionally for them, not just, like, what's going on in their head, which relates to God, because a lot of times what we have is we have the things that we think about God and we have the things that we feel about God. And we don't know, sometimes we don't even know the things that we feel about God is one way of putting it.
Yeah, totally. So. I mean, and I want to talk about this because you specifically relate your work, as you've said, kind of is about the intersection of faith and attachment science and kind of how that affects our relationships and with ourselves, our families, our partners, our neighbors, you know, and our relationship with God. You know, I'm thinking about that Tozer quote that I'm going to paraphrase this, but you know, Tozer said, what comes to our mind. What comes to our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us, which was, like, it was huge. It was helpful for me. It was revolutionary for me. But I realized that something also doesn't, like, when we think about God or when God comes up, something also comes into our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. Not just into our minds, not just into our brains, not just into our thoughts, but something comes into our bodies. And learning to pay attention to that is actually really key to learn sort of how you intuitively relate to God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And that's when we talk about attachment, we're talking about what's the quality of this relationship and how does the quality of that relationship impact our nervous system. Okay. So
say more about that. What is attachment? When you keep saying attachment, help us, like, what do you mean when you say attachment?
Yeah. So attachment is this idea of our attachment to others, our relationships. And this started with infants and mothers, but has been expanded across the timeline in all these different relationships. But really looking at what is the quality of this relationship? And how does this relationship impact my body? So what I mean is that, when you're a kid and you're really scared, right, that actually activates your fight or flight in your body.
Right.
And if you can go to a parent that gives you a hug that says, oh, this is really scary, let me hold you, there's a change that happens in your body. That's not just in your mind, right? You actually relax, you calm down. The cortisol, stops flowing. The oxytocin starts flowing. So not to get too nerdy, but the stress hormones stop and the good feeling hormones start. And so this really tells us that when we think about mental health and we think about mood and we think about just our experience of life is so dictated by the relationships that we have. Because if you feel scared and you go to a parent and that parent says, stop being such a baby, then you're like, okay, now I'm scared and I don't have anyone to support me when I'm scared. So now not only am I feeling this emotional pain, but I'm also feeling isolated in it. Mm-hmm. And what will happen then is the cortisol will continue flowing. And we might just get quiet. We might look okay on the outside. But that's going to actually impact, that's going to create stress. And that stress is going to show up in different ways.
You mentioned this. We started with mothers and infants. My son is 12. He'll be 13 next month. And when he was born, at least the hospital he was born at, they told us explicitly, hey, we used to take him away and do all these experiments and shake him upside down and put him on a cold metal pan, but we're actually going to like place him on your wife's like chest for like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that was like a new thing they were doing, but I think it had to do with this attachment science that you're talking about.
Yeah, definitely. John Bowlby, Dr. John Bowlby is the founder of attachment science, and he basically instituted a lot of changes in the medical system that we're seeing today. So, one of the things was, if we look at this kind of spectrum of trying to keep kids with parents while still doing, getting their medical needs taken care of, in the 50s and 60s, it was like, all right, like your kid, needs surgery, so they'll just be, at the hospital for a week and come pick them up in a week. And you think about being a five-year-old going through surgery and then recovering from surgery without your parent there. Now we're like, of course, like that makes no sense, but they didn't know that then.
They do open heart surgery outpatient. They just numb you up and they, get you out in 3 hours. So you're talking like biochemistry, you're talking nervous system. Like I didn't seminary didn't train me to think about any of this when I'm talking about God. So Crispin, maybe reverse engineer this for us, for me. How did you begin to connect the good stuff you inherited from your parents and from your upbringing as a Christian to we need to pay attention to our nervous system in order to be present to God?
Well, it's not that positive of a story, actually. So really what it was that I realized, so as I mentioned, grew up in the church, went to Bible college, you know, got my master's in counseling, but went into ministry. And all along, it was this, I was just noticing that I felt like this relationship with God, it feels so tenuous. There's this anxiety there around like, are we okay? You know, is our relationship okay? And some of that comes, I think the clearest example of that message that I got or where this came from is McGee and Me. Some of you may be familiar. Focus on the Family did this video series called McGee and Me. And the first episode is about this 11-year-old kid. His name's Nick. He lies about his neighbor, you know, feels guilty. Some things happen, but dad comes in for that scene to talk to him about him lying, right? And he says, you know, lying's bad because it hurts other people. But, you know, what's most important is, and this is a paraphrase, is that lying is a sin, and sin can cut off your relationship with God. And so I'm like, oh, yeah. So it makes sense that, like, even though I've been told you're saved by faith, it's not about works, it's a relationship, there's still the sense that, like, if I don't get it right, that I might not be okay. I might not be saved. And also, I might not be close to God in the way that I want to be. And so what I found then, I was reading this literature, and it was saying that, you know, kids where there's this sense that the parent expects these things from their kid in order to get closeness. So this would be this anxious attachment style of, as long as you're happy and behaving yourself and smiling, I want to cuddle you. And if you're crying or you're upset, like, go away, I don't want to be near you. And when we find that a child feels like their acceptance is based on behavior, it creates this sense in them that there's something about me that's broken or rotten or disgusting or shameful. And this is really develops before even speech. This is like the first 18 months of life. If you're familiar with Kurt Thompson's work in The Soul of Shame, he talks a lot about this. And so I was like, oh, so it makes sense that I feel like God doesn't really like me, that this is so tenuous. Like, if I take this attachment framework and think about the messages I've gotten, which is you have to be a good boy if God's going to stick around, it makes so much sense that you would be living with this anxiety. And what we found is that when people have that feeling about themselves, it impacts that parent-child relationship, but you also take it forward into your other relationships generally. And it only made sense to be like, oh, and this also applies to God. If I've been given this message that that there's something really wrong with me, but if I can be good enough, then God will come close. It just makes sense that I feel pretty anxious a lot of the time. So
have you ever considered getting trained as a lay counselor, Christy?
Actually, Ben, I have. partly because as a pastor, I get lots of families and students and kids wanting to meet and have questions and hurts and pains, and I just feel ill-equipped. In fact, the university that I went to sent out a survey saying, oh, you've been in ministry for 20 years, and what did you miss in your education that you wish you would have had? And the number one thing I wrote down in it was, I wish I would have had some sort of family and student or kid counseling course. Not because I'm a counselor, not because it would have trained me to be a counselor, but because I needed some tools. I need some tools when these hard conversations, when these hard situations happen. And I think Rispero actually gives some tools for our listeners, for people who want to go through that the course, that would be help of what I was looking for from my university.
Yeah. And Rispero is sponsoring today's episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast, and they do have training, as you said, to make that happen, to get trained as a lay counselor. You don't need to be a pastor in ministry for 20 years.
No.
You can just be somebody who wants...
You could be a mom. You could be a dad. You could be a coach or a mentor. Right.
Yeah. who just wants to learn how to better help people who are in pain or struggling. They offer the option to join a live cohort and participate in two courses led by Rispero founder Joe Bishop. He has been counseling people for over 35 years, and his hope is to train Rispero counselors to bring healing and comfort to a broken and hurting world, one conversation at a time. So if you're interested, the first step is taking the Understanding People course on Rispero's website. Rispero offers courses and lessons for people to understand themselves better or to recover from grief or spiritual abuse. They've got lessons on how to cope with disappointment, shame, addiction, and all kinds of other topics. We really believe that Rispero has something to offer for everyone. You can find out more about Rispero on social media at Rispero Restoring Hope or online at their website at rispero.org. That's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org. We hope you'll join them in their mission of bringing hope to a hurting and chaotic world. We come into relationships with like a whole host of experiences about relationships in general that we bring, you know, like when we meet a new person, it's not like a blank slate, like, oh, now I'm going to develop a completely different style of attachment because I met a new person. I think it's the same as true with God, right? We project our past experiences with our parents and with caregivers and all that kind of stuff. We project it onto God because we can't not. There has to be some sort of backdrop for us to actually have to think about God as a person that we can relate with. You have to bring that in, you know? And so, so that's kind of, I wonder, we could talk, you know, we could nerd out about the traditional attachment styles. I don't think, I want to do that. I'd love to hear you got this book coming up soon, soon in February. Is that right?
Yeah. February on,
I guess that's not super soon.
February 22nd, 2022 on a Tuesday. So it is
really Tuesday, 2/2/2/2.
Yeah. It is Tuesday.
That's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool release there.
Right. Yeah.
I can't forget it. When are all the twos coming?
Great. Right. Yeah.
No, that's great. And it's called Attached to God, A Practical Guide to Deeper Spiritual Experience. And what I like about what you've done here is you've taken sort of that attachment theory and thought about our relationship with God, and you've distilled it a little bit into four spiritual attachment styles. And these you just outlined one of them, which I think is the anxious spiritual attachment style. Can you just walk through what those are? Because I found as I read through these, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense of my experience and also my experience as a pastor, like talking with people who have difficulty relating to God. Like they seem like they're very, very common. So will you just walk us through those and kind of give us a picture of each spiritual attachment style?
Yeah, definitely. So when we think about, we'll start with secure relationship. And I guess two things I should say first. One is everyone is on a spectrum here. And so there are the, you know, you're going to identify more with one style than another, but you're never going to fall completely in one box. Okay. And what I find is more helpful, some people want to think like, you know, am I one of the insecure styles or am I a secure style? And what I think is helpful to think about is when I'm in an insecure place, where do I go to?
Good.
Yeah. Right. And then the one other thing I just want to say is that as we're talking about this, just attachment in general, don't try to assess your own children's attachment styles.
Fair warning.
Yeah, because there are for really what it takes for secure attachment is you have to get it right 50% of the time in the times when your kid needs you. So that doesn't mean you have to be perfect parent all the time. It means that like when your kid is in distress, you show up for them at least 50% of the time.
That's really helpful for me.
That pressure off. And if you're the parent that's like, you know, am I doing this right? Then you probably are developing a secure relationship with your kid. And there are some,
if you care about it, you're probably, you're on the right path. You're doing okay. Right. Don't feel bad.
So I just like to throw that out there. But when we look at secure relationships, that's the sense of like, I have a sense of myself as lovable, and I have a sense of God as loving me. And so I think about the prodigal son story. There are these elements that that show up there, because one is the son finds that I can go to my dad whenever I need, right? And actually, like, a lot of people, you know, will focus on he repented, you know, but really, like, what happens is, like, he's like, I'm out of food, right. I'm in need, yeah. I'm gonna go back to my dad's house, and maybe he'll take me back.
Yeah.
And so it's not like, oh, I don't know where my parent is. It's like, no, I can go and get the love that I need. Mm. The other is that the dad doesn't expect him to change, you know, so he's been like sleeping with pigs. Mm-hmm. And the dad hugs him. So you think about that. He doesn't say, like, in a lot of white evangelical theology, it's like, God loves you, but you have to be cleansed first. And I don't want to like go too nerdy into that part, but what I see in the prodigal son story is he's not like, go put on a clean shirt and then I'll give you a hug. He's like, I'm here. I'm just so excited that you're here. And then there's this element of delight, which is, I like you, you know, he throws a party. So it's not like, oh, you know, we need to make this right. You need to do this or that. It's like, no, let's just celebrate. I'm so glad that you're here. Mm-hmm. So that would be a picture of a secure relationship with God. The sense that God is on your side, that God likes you, that God loves you, and that you know, you don't have to be perfect in order to be close to God. And yeah.
Crispin, let me just offer an observation about that. So going back to this Tozer quote, right? Uh-huh. The most important thing about you is what comes to mind when you think about God. And going back to your observation that a lot of how we relate gets sort of downloaded as an operating system in some ways into mm-hmm. our like nervous system. So it's actually not mm-hmm. conscious. It's actually not something we're right. consciously yeah. choosing all the time. And so actually Tozer's not right. Like, we can tell ourselves that, oh yes, God's love's unconditional, but we can McGee mm-hmm. and me our way through a relationship with God, you right. know, like the best of them, mm-hmm. right? Which is kind of mm-hmm. what maybe you kind of named your experience growing up. I'm sure you heard, like, you know, there's nothing right, you yeah. can do to earn God's love. It's unmerited mm-hmm. favor and, right, getting mm-hmm. what you don't deserve. Yeah. But then right. there is this anxiety that winds us from the inside mm-hmm. that lives mm-hmm. in our bones, mm-hmm. you know, lives in our bodies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's something that, something I'm really interested in is that dynamic of, where do these unhelpful, images of God come from? And the research generally says that family of origin is generally where we get that from, the family that we grew up with. And actually mothers more than fathers typically, but I have a hesitation about that narrative because it can then get toxic theology off of the hook in the sense that it's like, yeah, like you have a hard time trusting God because you grew up in a dysfunctional family. And I remember talking with a friend once who said, I told him, I said, like, you know, I'm bringing these things up in our church and saying, you know, let's think about how these theologies and teachings come across. And I said, but I'm just really worried. Like, I know that I grew up in a dysfunctional family. What if people are just thinking, like, that's just Crispin's baggage? Mm. And he was like, no, like, because you grew up in that system, you have a keen eye for what's dysfunctional. And if you're like, this feels familiar, then... like, that's actually a gift to the church. So,
that's good.
You know, if you grow up with a parent that really demands a lot of you for you to really be liked or loved, then you get to church and you're like, wait a minute, like, this kind of feels familiar. Mm. That's actually a gift to the church to say, like, well, let's go back and see, like, what's going on here. And I think that one thing that I will say is that no matter where this insecurity comes from, it's important that the church looks at how do we heal these things. So rather than saying, well, that's just your baggage, yeah. Let's say, okay, so you are coming in with this harm done, this relational framework. What is, this sounds heretical, what is the God that you need? But I think if we're talking about listening to people with trauma and that have suffered, and we say, what do you need? That totally fits with the story of Scripture, because especially in the thinking about Old Testament and the Hebrew story, like that is God's MO, is like, there's a time of need, I'm going to show up. And kind of fit that. So
And Jesus does this in the Gospels too, right? He brings whatever is needed, whatever love demands in each relationship he brings, you know, it's not like he's got to give you every aspect of every atonement theory in every interaction. You know what I mean? Like he can just say, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. He can just say that. That's enough of a word of good news for.
And I know we have I know we have two more styles, but I just want to put
three more.
Well, we have anxious and secure. Is there, are there two more or three?
Right. Anxious. So we're talking about security. And then if we talked about insecure styles, we have anxious, which we've talked about a little bit. Then we also have shut down, and we have shut down, and then we have shame filled.
Okay. So. Well, I just want to point out for a moment here that there may be listeners who are realizing for the first time that they inherited a sort of an anxious attachment style and went searching for a Christian system or tradition that fit that. That and there are, I think, theological streams or traditions that do keep us anxious, perpetually anxious. And that becomes sort of this toxic, we have a toxic spirituality bred out of an anxious attachment with some kind of Frankenstein God, right? That is an amalgamation of our, you know, pre-18-month experiences in our family, right? So I just want to have a moment just to say, like, if you're realizing that, you're reckoning with that, it's a big deal, right, Crispin? I mean, you're the pro here, not me, but that's like a big deal to reckon with that,
Yeah, definitely. It is. It's... My hope is that it's freeing for people to be able to put words to this experience. You know, there's this experience I've had, this feeling I've had, and it doesn't, it's especially hard to put your finger on because of the explicit theological things that we're taught, right? But we need to make some room for like, well, how do I feel about this? And before we move on to the other styles, I got to tell you about this part because we've been mentioning Tozer. and I actually spend some time in my book talking about him. I don't know his attachment style. That wouldn't be ethical or whatever. But what we found with the toddlers that were anxious about that connection, they would sit right next to mom and they would hold on to her skirt. And they wouldn't go play. They wouldn't go explore. Because it's like, it's up to me to maintain this relationship. Oh, it's up to me. So I need to really focus on mom. And what that means is I can't learn and grow and develop and do all these things.
Right.
So it kind of leads to this question, like, can we be too preoccupied with God?
Yeah. Dude, you're blowing my freaking mind.
Well, and so then looking at Tozer's life, I read a biography of his, and it was fascinating because he was so such what we would give a picture in the church of what devotion looks like. And so
He's held up as this like
He, you know, he had his he would just spend hours praying. He had his praying pants that, you know, so we wouldn't wear the knees out of literally. He would he would change into his praying pants. And you know, that like his assistant or secretary or whatever would walk in periodically and find him just kind of like moaning on the floor in prayer. That was literally the word used in the biography. And he also, he would refuse raises. He would often, he didn't want anything to distract him from the pursuit of God. So if he would get money, a lot of times he would donate it. He would then like his books, he signed the rights away to so that they would support ministries, which is sounds so great and is great in a lot of ways. But when you talk to his family, they're like, we never went on vacation. His wife needed a car. He wouldn't buy a car because he didn't want wealth to distract from pursuing God. So she would either have to brave the cold Chicago winters or get rides from church members. And he died before she did. She remarried somewhat soon afterward. And someone said, like, you know, what's it like being married to this new guy, Leonard? And she was like, Leonard loves me. Tozer loved Jesus. And so it's this picture of, like, he was so consumed with wanting to have this connection with God. But it ended up sort of hampering his ability to engage with the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And it makes me think again of the toddler that's like clinging to this mom's skirt, but can't go like play with toys or talk to other kids or, you know, and that's where I think that's such a sadly poignant picture in the church, where this anxious attachment style of, like, you know, always that thing of like, make sure that you're thinking this week, like, where are you at with God? How are you, are you staying close to God?
Did you do quiet time?
Right.
You know, like all that kind of,
So,
wow. Yeah. Dude, that we could do a podcast series about that, because it's so sneaky, right? That what looks, and, you know, Tozer's, I mean, and there's a lot of good that has come from his work, obviously, as well. So it's not, you know, black or white,
right,
or good or bad, but like just the way that sort of anxious attachment hides in plain sight in the church is fascinating.
And that sometimes is praised and rewarded too.
Well, it's held up as the, I mean, you're more passionate, right? And you're more on zeal. You're more on fire. You're more, you know.
The longer you can
pray. You're not wasting your life.
The more praying pants you move through. Blew out the knees in another pair of praying pants. I don't mean to make fun of Tozer's praying pants, but it tickles me a little bit.
All right. Well,
okay, so secure attachment is, and then the other three styles are insecure in some way or another.
Right, So that's like when I'm worried about this relationship in some way, and here are the ways that I cope with it. So one is doing that really anxious thing of like, I'm gonna, you know, I want to be close to you, and I'm gonna focus on that instead of focusing in a balanced way on everything in my life.
Yeah.
The
taking my family on vacation.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can
I just say a lot of modern worship music strikes me as anxious. Mm-hmm. It comes from an anxious place. It comes from like, I just want to be close to you. I just want to do this. I love you so much, Jesus. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And sure, I think a lot of that can be an authentic overflow of emotion.
Right.
But it strikes me that like the need to keep sort of harping on that sometimes can be a manifestation of an anxious spirituality. Well,
I think about if I actually were to say that to my mom, I just want to be close to you,
or my wife. Yeah,
they would say, aren't we? We are.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you? What are you doing?
I thought we were okay. We were sitting here in the kitchen. Like, what are you talking about?
Do I need to check the bank account right now? What'd you do?
Cut the cucumbers. Why are you telling me about,
Yeah, right. Well, and that's actually when thinking about couples therapy and that happens where it's like, are we okay? Like I need to check in with you all the time. Like I texted you and it's been an hour. What's wrong? Is there something wrong? Yeah. You know? There's it's mostly speculative. But Todd Hall wrote a book, co-authored an article with some other psychologists. He's at Biola at Rosemead. And he talks about these attachment styles. And there's at least some kind of theories based on some preliminary research that when we continually approach God in that way of continually you know, I need this worship experience to feel right. close.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We go through these cycles where we have to keep coming back to that in order to feel okay.
Ugh. Dude. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has all the hallmarks of an addiction.
Mm-hmm. Obsession.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So,
all right.
That's, so that's one.
Sorry,
piece.
Crispin. This is great.
Yeah.
So anxious. I think we've got a good picture of anxious. Yeah. You started to talk about shutdown. Yeah. Spirituality. What's that?
Right. So shutdown, it might be helpful to give a picture of what that looks, what a avoidant, dismissive attachment style, which is what I'm talking about here. Okay. If that doesn't mean anything to you, forget I said it. Don't get hung up on the terms. It gets confusing soon.
Delete it from the record.
Right. Yep. But or it gets confusing quickly. Yeah. But really, the you know, it's kind of this person that says, I don't really need others. You know, my relationships are fine. I'm good. I don't really like to talk about emotions. I don't like, you know, I don't feel emotions. Like, I'm fine. And I would rather just like go work on a project. And you know, of course, like in the US, we tend to think of, and especially in the church, these are kind of stereotypical male, you know, personality,
stoic.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Traits. And so what this looks like in faith is, well, where that comes from, actually, this being allergic to emotions, it comes from this place. If you grow up and say you're a kid and you're at the park and you skin your knee and you look over at mom and you know, all right, I could go over and get a hug, but like she's actually going to be annoyed that I'm hurt. She's going to be frustrated that I'm crying. If we get those messages growing up, consistently, because there are times with my own kids where I'm like, you know, you're freaking out right now. Like, this is an oversized reaction. But if we consistently get a message that your emotions are not okay, then what we end up doing is emotions are built for connection, right? I cry, you give me a hug. But if I learn that me crying actually leads to punishment or being rejected, then what's the point of emotions for me? And so then I grew up thinking emotions actually lead to disconnection. Mm-hmm. And so if I want to keep the people that I love close to me, I got to just stuff those emotions down. Yeah. And actually you get to this point where your brain changes so that it's much easier for you to dismiss the emotions in your that are coming up in your body.
Wow. Your brain literally changes.
Yes. Uh-huh.
To enable you to ignore what your body is telling you about how you feel.
Right, yeah. The insula is this part of your brain that translates body sensations into emotions, and it gets smaller in people with this attachment style. That's again from Kurt Thompson's research.
Yes.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
So I got a B- in pastoral counseling in seminary, and I've only seen like 3 episodes of Dr. Phil, but I'm noticing that both of these attachment styles are adaptations to deal with pain.
Yes.
Right. They're survival mechanisms.
Yeah, they're ways of getting the... Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. It's how you get... Thanks for bringing that up. That's the whole core of it. So good job, Matt.
You get an A in pastoral counseling now. Retroactive.
how do I get the closeness that I need? If I can't just walk up to dad and get a hug, right? Like the prodigal son.
How do I get it? I pull on his coat until he hugs me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I pull on his coat until he hugs me. Or as long as I can just be stoic, then at least I can stay.
And do a good job mowing the lawn.
Mm-hmm. Then I can then stay kind of close. Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And actually, infants with this shutdown style, they've tracked that they see that the kid will hang out in this zone around the parent that's not too close and not too far. Hmm. I want closeness, but I know that if I get too close, my parent will reject me. So I need to just like stay in this orbit around them.
Yeah.
And so they look, and these kids look happy. They go and they play, they try to distract themselves, right? Like, all right, I got a skinned knee. I know if I go to mom, she's going to make me feel bad for crying. I'm just going to go like suck it up and I'm going to go play on the monkey bars, you know, and do something. And so what this looks like is I have to, my emotions are a barrier to my connection with God. And this goes both ways. So these are people that see emotions as kind of the opposite of faith. We've seen this in the last year, right? Faith over fear. Fear is not an emotion from God. Or, you know, Piper tweeted that thing recently from John Powell that worry is a mild form of atheism. In my book, I kind of go through just kind of pick apart some different quotes from people. One that I think is most poignant is Francis Chan says that that worry and anxiety is basically like odorous to God. You know, because it's, you know, the idea is that we don't trust God. But when you think about that, this idea of like God finds it, you know, foul or disgusting, it brings up that feeling again of like, I can't get close to God. God's going to be disgusted with me because I have these emotions. But it flips the other way, which is these are people that are like likely to be like, you know what? Like, yeah, my kid is totally floundering in college freshman year, but it's fine. Like, God has a plan. I don't need to worry about it. And what they're doing is they're shutting down their emotions through their spirituality. So it kind of goes both ways.
We refer to that sometimes as spiritual bypassing, like. Right? Mm-hmm. Like we use God or we use the Bible to get away from reality, like to not reckon with what's real.
Mm-hmm. Oof. Yeah, totally. Again,
to avoid the pain of what would that mean if my relationship with my kid was broken or there was, you know, a lot to walk through or, you know, like it would just be a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And the memories of like what happens when I confront that pain or when I feel that emotion, well, it's just more pain. So why?
You know? Yeah. Right. Yeah. And in looking at this, I mean, the founder of attachment science, John Bowlby, he was really against the idea of pathologizing people or saying that people were dysfunctional. He would say like, this is just, our brains are, you know, didn't say it this way, but our brains are so amazing that if we learn that emotions lead to disconnection, we're going to get really good at just shutting down those emotions. You know, and even talking to people as a therapist, it's like, well, how does that feel? Or like, let's kind of dig into your feelings. And I get it when they're like, why would I want to do that? It's uncomfortable. I don't know what they are. And whenever I've talked about them before, people just run and scream in the other direction. There's no point in talking about my emotions.
Why am I paying you to ask me this? What am I doing?
And so, you know, then that you can just see that kind of stream of Christianity which really can look at, you know, what's the most logical, systemic way to approach things. And again, looks at like emotions. You know, I look at emotions as a sign of something. It's telling me something. But they're looking at emotions as kind of the opposite of faith. So often.
Yeah. If you're experiencing, especially negative emotions, if it's anything other than joy or contentment, it's evidence, gratitude, that's a good one. But if it's fear or worry, anxiety, anger, then it's evidence that like there's something wrong that needs to be fixed. Like, mm-hmm. so you can stop feeling that emotion so you can kind of get on with your life rather than listening to the emotion saying like, I wonder why I'm angry mm-hmm. or, you know, what's going on right now. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is super helpful. I feel like we could talk about, I want to keep us moving though.
Right. Yeah.
So secure attachment, the two styles we've talked about so far of insecure attachment are anxious and shut down. I may or may not have identified with one of those. So Matt, you can maybe guess that. No, we're not supposed to do that, right, Crispin? No. We're not supposed to try to identify other people's.
Yeah, that's true. Well, just don't try to like measure your the quality of attachment with your kid. That's my
just don't do that. Rule. All right, very good. So there's one more insecure style. Mm-hmm. Walk us through that one.
And yeah.
I have a couple more questions for you.
Right. So this is shame-filled. And and what this is that there's something really broken inside of me that God is disgusted with. And so what this looks like is where we try to get close to God by punishing or shaming ourselves, right? Before God can get a chance to do that to us in a sense.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the like, I'm a wretched sinner, right? I'm a worm.
Right.
But again, if we hold this attachment framework, how are we trying to get connection? We're trying to get connection, right? By proving to God that we know we don't deserve it. And so, you know, it's kind of like, all right, I need to be holy to be close to God. I can't be holy. So at least I can, you know, prove to God that I understand how unholy I am.
Right, right.
I
remember Dallas Willard, I think, talked about in The Divine Conspiracy. He's talking about like that there's a spirituality. I feel like I'm going to butcher this, but he said basically like it's not faith by works, but it's like it's almost like faith by knowing it's not by works, like faith by my knowledge of how uninvolved my works can be. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
but it's not really actually faith in God. It's faith in my awareness of how bad I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
So I hear little shades of that in what you're saying, shame filled.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's what we, oh my gosh, I'm spacing on the name of the theologian. So I'll look it up and send it to you later for show notes. But he talks about, you know, when we realize we can't bring anything good to God, we can at least bring like self-condemnation and self-hatred, you know, and that this actually, the shame-filled part is where I started first thinking about attachment in spirituality. So kids that grow up with attachment trauma, emotional neglect or abuse, they will feel like there's something at their core that is disgusting. So it's like, it's like there's something about me at my core that drives others away. And so they'll say things like, I feel, you know, all like dirty inside. I feel like a rat. I feel like a pigeon, you know? And this is just kind of a lot of the literature of people that have worked with kids that have, a lot of like kids in the foster care system, it would be a good example of this. And I was reading that, you know, this idea that, you know, my heart is black, which is a phrase that I don't like because of the history of white supremacy in this country.
Right. Yeah. That takes on some different meanings. Yeah.
Yes. But what I think is important about that is it was like, wait a minute. This was like the thing that I was told with the, you know, the wordless book. If you're familiar, it's a book, quote unquote. My grandma made them out of felt pages, and each page is just a color. And so,
called the wordless book.
So,
red and black and white,
gold. Don't forget gold.
And you know,
the streets of heaven.
If you grew up in an evangelical church, you probably had some exposure to this sort of thing. But, you know, this idea that your heart is dirty or your heart is black in this case and it needs to be cleansed. And I was like, wait a minute. Like, what does it mean that kids that have gone through emotional abuse or neglect or worse have that feeling. But I was told in Sunday school, like, that your heart is black. And no wonder it resonates, that shame resonates. And if you're told this from a young age,
it feels true.
And I've talked to, it feels true. And actually, if you go back in the research, find out, I went back and found out where this was first used. It was first used, first used by Charles Spurgeon. Mm-hmm. It's attributed to him. And the first place he presented this wordless book concept was in England. He had this special evangelistic event where they brought all the kids from the orphanages in London to hear this gospel presentation. So I'm like, of course it resonated. Like, just the start of this, like, you know, hundreds of years ago, it makes sense that these kids are like, oh yeah, it totally feels like I have a black heart, or, you know, that there's something really wrong with me at my core. Yes. And so that shame-filled thing is like when we just live there, when we stay there with like, I am so broken, and we really like obscure the imago Dei, you know? And even growing up, I mean, of course we have to figure out, how do we talk about sin? How do we talk about brokenness? But I've come to this idea that we are, at our core, created by God and loved by God, and that is the most true thing about us. And on the outside, there are these ways that we're broken or you know, kind of dirty on the outside. What I was told growing up is, you might look good on the outside, but at your core, you're totally broken. And that really does it. I guess one last way that I'll put it, I'm hoping that as people are hearing this, that it's just like maybe making some connections, because that's what I did reading this, was like, oh, like it's starting to come together why I've felt this way. But Brené Brown, her definition of shame is this feeling that I've fallen below a standard, and therefore I'm undeserving of love or belonging. And I was like, that actually just describes the gospel message that I was told when I was a kid.
Right.
Is, you've sinned.
You've missed the mark.
You've missed the mark. Yeah. Right. Therefore, you don't deserve to be with God. You deserve isolation. And again, this is really complicated. I'm not doing my theology based on Brené Brown's definition of shame.
Sure.
But it really helps us be like, oh, like if this is the message we've been given, then it just totally makes sense that that it's going to resonate in this emotional way, in a bad emotional way.
Right. It's going to resonate in all the wrong ways.
Exactly.
You know, and reinforce that harmful pattern.
Then, because we can't live under crippling shame, like it actually leads to despair, hopelessness, and often like despondency and suicide. Like humans can't function with this. We need some kind of transactional divine package to alleviate our shame and release us into this sweet heavenly jouissance where we get freed, right? So then we have a gospel that's simply about releasing us from the prison of shame that we've constructed. But it's a momentary like whatever. But then we're because the internal shame hasn't been dealt with in any way, we need that next week as well.
Right. Yeah. And there are so many aspects to this. One thing that I think is so unhelpful is that we've constructed a gospel, the whole courtroom judgment thing, right? It's like you're told, hey, your sins aren't counted against you. You can walk free. But really, it's not that we want to know that our we don't want to know like, oh, I'm not going to be punished for my sins. We want to know God likes me. God loves me.
Right.
We don't want a get out of jail free card. We actually want a hug, right? We
want acquittal. God to
wrap
the
us
judge
up in
who acquits me doesn't have to like me or love me.
Right. Yeah.
And hopefully I'll never see him again.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I talked to this. I had this client years ago, who he said, and I tell this story often enough. He's someone who's been through a lot of trauma. And he said, just really rough life. And he said, you know, me and the big guy have an agreement. I don't like him. He doesn't like me. And I know where I'm going when I die.
Wow.
And I said, I was like, well, you know, there are some traditions that say hell is this experience of the parts of us that aren't loving being burned away. And that's a painful process. But this idea that, you know, George MacDonald would say this, that we can't escape God. And so God is a consuming fire. God is with us. And he said, I wouldn't, he just totally softened. And he said, I wouldn't mind burning for a while as long as God wanted to keep me around.
Geez, dude.
Oh my gosh.
Right. Which is like, yeah, we don't want to be punished, but this attachment longing of like, I want to be loved.
The guy who basically told you he's going to hell, he may have had the purest confession of faith I've ever heard.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's like, I don't even.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that parallels those kids that, you know, psychology asked for a long time. Like, so Freud said, kids love their parents because their parents feed them and protect them. And yet we know kids that are not fed or protected or are hurt by their parents that will still love them so much and need that connection because that's what we need. Ugh. And I think that is what, if we just want to look at, you know, what would a Christian leader walk away with? People want to connect with God. And they're trying their hardest. And it doesn't mean that they're perfect. But being able to take a step back and ask, like, in what ways is this person or my congregation trying to pursue God? And, you know, in what ways is it working or not?
Yeah.
Because I hear too many stories of, I've been part of too many churches where it's like, you're not trying hard enough. You're not.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't care about God. You don't love God enough. But I think that underneath all of it, like, of course we want that connection with God. But if we've learned that relationship is too painful, of course we're going to go somewhere else or we're going to find other ways of managing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just that's a beautiful piece of advice, I think, for leaders, just to have that lens of grace. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? If you stand up to preach and they're in the room,
right,
they're seeking God. You know, they don't have to go to church. They want to be with God. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, they're in church. So anyway, one last question for you. I think that's really helpful. One last question: if maybe some of our listeners are recognizing themselves as I did, as you described these things, like recognizing their approach to God and feeling like I do want to belong to God. I do want to move into more consistent, like secure spiritual attachment to God. Mm-hmm. Like what would you tell people? Cause you know, we've talked about this. You can't just like cram extra God facts into your mind. You know, you can't just read another book, even though those things can be helpful. Mm-hmm. But like, what would you recommend to somebody who is like, I really want this, but I'm recognizing that, man, I've got these other styles that come up a lot.
Yeah. There are really concrete things that you can do to address this. And it depends on your attachment style. And so I'm really excited for my book to come out because this sounds like book promotion, but it literally is like, there are concrete exercises that I have in the book. But it, you know, it depends on figuring out kind of like what's the thing that I'm working on. But I think just a starting point, and if listeners want to also, before it's released, I do have a newsletter that I try to do monthly at my website, crispinmayfield.com. It's the Secure Spirituality newsletter. So I've done some of the exercises there. But one really great place to start is to do a little bit of a self art therapy. So draw a picture of you and God in that relationship, or draw a picture of what God looks like, or, I usually draw stick figures. It does not have to be good.
that's about my level. So I'm right, glad to hear you say that.
But you know, for some people it might be like a collage, like pulling out some magazines what is it that, you know, when I really, focus on what it's like to be close with God, how does it feel? Mm. And that's so abstract, but I think that a lot of us have that idea of, you know, on a level of 1 to 10, when I think about God being close, do I feel comfortable or uncomfortable? But just drawing a picture, like if God and I were in a room, what would the room look like? How far apart would you be sitting? What do I look like? What does God look like? And that's a way of starting to access, like, what is it that's going on underneath my thoughts, my theological thoughts. And then there are places to go with that, but I think just bringing an awareness to that first is definitely the first step for whoever it is.
That's awesome, Crispin.
Yeah, what a gift. Yeah. Crispin, I'm thinking through, you know, for most of our listeners, maybe this anxious attachment or this distant avoidant attachment or this shame-filled attachment, maybe describe like the options or choices they had about Christian theology. Like these are the only ways to approach God. And just the fact that you're naming these as adaptations, and you're also, you know, describing this picture of a secure attachment as maybe the orienting center or telos of what a vibrant Jesus-centered spirituality could be is a gift to us. So thank you. And thanks for this book. I gotta wait 6 months. I can't believe it.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I'll pre-order it. Though,
yeah, that's what I'll do. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The last thing that I'd throw in here is I've a podcast called Attached to the Invisible. And there's some resources there. But also my wife and I do a podcast on evangelical media from the 80s and 90s and also 2000s.
What?
Awesome. So we started out looking at Adventures in Odyssey. But this most recent season is called Shamecore Records, and we're looking at Christian hardcore. So here's my pitch. If you're hearing this and you're like, I don't listen to that screaming music, that's fine. What I'm looking at is that these bands, there wasn't a lot of censorship. And so I kind of along these lines in terms of like when you're artistic, right? Like there are things that come out that maybe you wouldn't have been able to put a finger on before. I found that with Christian hardcore lyrics. And so basically what I'm doing is I'm looking at these different lyrics and passages and then tying that with an attachment lens to like, what does this teach us about the experience of of evangelicalism? So for example, when Under Oath screams, hold me close, wash my mind, destroy the me that lives inside. Ooh. Right? That's this message of like, if I'm going to get close to God, which is that from an attachment lens, the thing that I long for, I have to no longer be myself. I have to destroy myself. Later in the album, he talks about, you know, God take me because I hate me. And it's like, oh yeah, like that feeling of like, I have to hate myself in order to get close to God. You're like, yeah, it's not that as explicit as he's saying, but it is like hiding in the corners of the church.
Yeah,
totally.
You know, and so that's what I've kind of done is like, all right, like let's look at all these like, you know, teenagers and early 20-year-olds that, you know, are part of this evangelical space, but, you know, nobody is saying like, well, you know, what do you mean here? Like, as long as you don't swear or talk about drugs or sex, like you're fine.
You're fine. You can scream whatever you want about hating yourself.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So yeah, if people are like, you know, thinking like, oh yeah, this is making sense. It's been a really fun season to interview people. And I've done a little bit more of a produced aspect of like taking some of my attachment kind of framework and asking some questions there. Oh, so,
dude, that's called Shamecore Records. If people just search for that. All right. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
I'm pretty sure the podcast is called Prophetic Imagination Station, which is a combo of a Walter Brueggemann book and Adventures in Odyssey reference.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Prophetic Imagination
Station. I love this.
The specific season that we've been going through is Shamecore Records.
So, dude, I could pick your therapist brain about like, cause what came to mind for me is like, I was a pretty straight laced kid growing up, but I started a punk rock band in ninth grade. And I was surprised at the lyrics that I wrote, like coming out of this, like I was like, I had no idea. It was like, this anger is coming from somewhere.
Right.
And I wasn't aware of how angry I was until I started singing my own lyrics, in a punk rock band.
Yeah.
Yeah. They call that.
So anyway, it's pretty.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The first episode of the season, I just got to highlight this cause she's doing such great work. Becky Castle Miller.
Yeah.
Interviewed her. Okay. Yeah. Interviewed her and we kind of talked about this, like, what are the rules about emotions in evangelicalism coming from LaHaye and Dobson? That really explains why like the Tooth and Nail record label in particular just took off. Cause it's like, here's this, right. Yeah. You know, you want to be straight laced, like, and then all of a sudden, like, here's this space that you can say whatever you want.
Right.
And it was a lifesaver for a lot of us, and also like, you know, unhelpful in other ways.
Right. So. Yeah. It's, everything's always a little bit gray. Well, Crispin, this is awesome. So just to reiterate, if you want to explore this further, pre-order the book. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Go to CrispinMayfield.com. That's Crispin with a K, Mayfield.com. Your newsletter is there. Your podcast is there. And then we'll also put a link to this other podcast, the Prophetic Imagination Station.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see the logo.
it's great. Thank you so much for talking about attachment. Yeah. As you can tell, it just really energizes me. And like I said, just this ability to be able to like, here's this feeling that I've had. Let's look at attachment research and say like, there's a really good reason that you feel this way.
Yes.
And that gives us an idea of like, where do we go from here?
So good. So.
Dude.
It's been challenging, been so cathartic, thank you. Beautiful. Thank you, Crispin. Uh-huh.
Yeah. All the things that Christian hardcore is. All right.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.